Welcome back. I'm Gary Parr.
And I'm Christine Williams.
And you're listening to Fiber Talk, as we always say, the weekly podcast for people who play with needles.
Indeed, yes. We do.
And we have two guests with us this week. We have the law firm of Tess and Thorne with us. No, it's Brooke McGowan and Tess Nagel of the Needle Point Canvas company, Tess and Thorne. So very excited to have you ladies with us. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much for having us.
Okay, so we got to help the listeners identify voices. So Brooke, say hi. I'm Brooke.
Hi, I'm Brooke.
Okay, that's what Brooke sounds like. Tess, what do you sound like?
I sound like this.
Oh, that's wonderful.
I have a cold, so I'm a little bit more nasally.
Well, that's good. That actually helps us.
Have more of
yeah, there you go.
I mean, not that it's good that you have a cold. That's
oh,
not
no,
quite what I meant, but, you know.
No, it'll help distinguish, hopefully, a little bit.
As I was saying before we started recording, that we're not going to talk about, I'm not going to read a long bio because that's what's interesting about these guys is how they got started and what they're doing. So, but I will read this one sentence that comes off their website. Tess and Thorne are two young bloods on a mission to feed an age of addiction with some fresh threads and what we like to call soul stitching. I love that.
You got it.
You
got it.
That's right. Yeah.
I can appreciate that.
So,
like, who can't get behind a message like that, really?
Thank you.
Well, we have to start out, what are we working on? And, of course, now we're recording these things way ahead of time. So we've been talking about Christine's knitted hat for weeks on end.
7,000 years.
Yeah.
I've been knitting that hat for 7,000 years. Yeah. So, right. So I'm actually not knitting that hat anymore. Because I keep getting requests for the Women's March pussy hat, so that's what I'm working on. So I'm knitting my first pussy hat for a guy.
Oh, right, that's now. Awesome.
So one of my guy friends was like, dude, can you make that? And I said, yeah, of course so. So he's like, I would love one. So that is what I'm doing.
Okay. We participated in the march in Boston, and I think one of the most fulfilling thing was seeing grown men with their, you know, small little boys all wearing matching hats. So that's really awesome.
Yes. Yes. We have the Science March actually coming up now. So that we're looking forward to. So there's all kinds of. Go ahead.
No, it's okay. I live with seven engineers. So
there you go. Okay. So
we're ready for
live
it.
In my world, right? So,
yeah.
So it's been fun to actually watch sort of the different ways that people are taking the original pussy hat and sort of bastardizing it into a Science March hat. Mm-hmm. So there's all kinds of like brain hats and DNA hats and all kinds of stuff going on. So that's going to be really super fun to see.
Well, I want the t-shirt. I saw a picture of Tom Hanks wearing the t-shirt. There is no Planet B.
So. Oh,
I like that
too.
One.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a pretty straightforward way to explain it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah, so I got to get that shirt. But I think these I'm energized by these marches. I didn't join the Women's March because I had something else going on. But you know that it's making it clear to the powers that be that people are paying attention. And
yes. Well, Jeremy and I already have our t-shirts picked out for the Science March, so that's going to be good.
All right.
That's perfect.
Yes. So okay, so that's what I'm working on.
Okay, well, that's good. That's good. We're recording this, but by the time it airs, I will have long been done with the Lady Edith geometric, because when we're recording it, after we get done, I'm going to go down, and I'm about an hour's away from finishing that up.
That's amazing.
Yeah, so that I'm pleased with that. And then I'm on to Debbie Rowley's Crisscross, which I originally said I was going to do in whites and creams. And I went to pick out the threads, and we laid out all the threads, and it was just blah.
Right.
And we looked at the chart and the stitches Debbie had chosen, and I decided to do it in a whole grayscale thing instead.
Yeah, I saw it on Needlepoint Nation, and it looked really good. And then it was funny because you were looking for accent colors, and I had suggested yellow and purple. And then I went and looked at the actual pattern and realized that the entire pattern is done in yellow and purple. So very creative of me.
Yeah, I wasn't going to embarrass you by saying.
Oh no, please go right ahead. I noticed it immediately. So wow, that was not creative at all, but okay.
Well, mustard is all the rage these days.
There you go. And both go very well with gray. They both complement gray very well. Yeah. So.
But I may do the whole thing in grayscale and from white all the way to almost black, and then I may just do one stitch, one small section in a color just to mess with things.
Ooh, so. I like
red.
That.
To red then.
And I have a lot of red threads, so I might that's what my thinking is right now, is to just drop in one little splotch of color. So.
Mm-hmm. I love that idea.
Sounds great.
Yep.
That's perfect.
So that'll be by the time this airs, I'll be well into that one. Yes. So, Brooke, what's going on?
Yeah. Gosh, what am I not working on? So we do a lot of our samples. So I probably have about 15 projects going, and I just put together, I think, 4 that are finished to go off to. We do our finishing through our local needlepoint shop in Dorset, Vermont. And Maria there has been a huge supportive for us. So I like to filter them through there. So
Name the shop. What's the shop?
Yes. In Stitches, Fine Needlepoint in Dorset, Vermont. And Maria's our needlepoint guru. And we can get into it more later. But she ultimately connected me with Tess's mom and therefore Tess. So shout out to Maria. but I think the one that I'm really excited about is I'm currently stitching our Eleanor design, which is the orange and purple elephant.
Yes.
And I have a very short attention span, so it's really fun to jump. That's the beauty of needlepoint. So you can jump back and forth with different colors. And so I'm like, oh, I'm sick of this purple. And then I switch to like aquamarine or something like that. So that's the one that I'm working on right now.
Now that one, there's several color areas in that canvas. So
yeah.
different stitches for each one.
You've done your research.
A little bit.
I'm doing so far about 3 different stitches. Because I'm trying to stitch in volume, I don't get too intricate right now. But I kind of go back and forth between 3 of my favorite stitches, which are basket weave, which is, kind of the basics. And then there's another one called cashmere, which ends up looking like a knitted sweater. And then another one called diagonal mosaic. So those are kind of my 3 go-tos. So the elephant's all in basket weave, the orange is all done in diagonal mosaic, and then the purple border will be in cashmere.
Mm. Well, that's a neat design.
Cashmere stitch, not cashmere wool. But
oh, go ahead and do it in cashmere wool, too. Go ahead. Tess, what do you got going?
That would be really nice.
I am currently stitching our Biggie Smalls design.
Woo! I love that one.
Yeah,
I love
so
it.
Fun.
He's our first design.
Yes, he holds a special place in our hearts.
He's your first design, and you're is this the first time you stitched it, or are you doing it?
Brooke, you stitched it once, didn't you? Or
again, we can talk about it more, but later, but. That was kind of the first project that I did.
Ever.
That then, I had done 3 other designs by other designers and then eventually started designing my own. And that was kind of the first trial and kind of sparked the birth of Tessum Thorn. But in order to keep the momentum going, I ended up selling that first pillow. So he now lives in Greenwich, Connecticut with his new family. But I definitely plan on stitching him again for myself.
Yeah. Neat.
Yeah, it's a fun one.
So, okay, so what, because clearly we've taken a little bit of a departure from the traditional types of needlepoint. So I would love to know what it is that got into your head that said, you know, Biggie Smalls would make an awesome needlepoint design. Like, how does that thought happen?
You know, my parents are very old school. I really was only allowed to listen to classic rock growing up, or jazz or blues. So our household was very Doris Day, Duke Ellington, Jimi Hendrix. Although I grew up in the 90s, Britney Spears and Backstreet Boys just were not in my house at all. And then once my mom got remarried, I got two new stepbrothers. And I think my sophomore year of high school, I did a portrait of Biggie Smalls for my stepbrother, Jasper, because he really loved him. And so that kind of – he kind of introduced that whole world to me. And that really then, you know, opened my eyes a lot about what was out there. And, you know, so I had this really traditional – upbringing, and then that was kind of a departure from that, as is, you know, needlepoint's a very traditional art form. It's been around since the Egyptians, very popular amongst women in the drawing room, and things like that. And kind of when I was trying to think outside the box of what needlepoint could be, Biggie Smalls seemed like a perfect
yes
vehicle for that, not only because he's greatly influenced my work a lot. You know, he and Tupac were feminists and back in the day and stuff like that. So I thought, you know, there was this one line, it's like, to all the ladies in the place of style and grace.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, that just warrants a pink and purple Biggie Smalls needlepoint.
Yes.
So I kind of loved kind of honoring him in that tradition, but also the irony behind, you know,
yes. Agreed.
Biggie Smalls in that color palette and in this art form. And so then I was in the Detroit airport visiting my family in on my way to visit my family in Michigan, and all these women were coming up to me being like, where did you get that? I have never seen that kind of needlepoint. And this was probably June of 2015. I had just graduated from college. And so I told my mom about it, and she was like, you know what? Now that I think about it, I don't think I've ever seen anything like that. So that was kind of the beginning of where we are now.
It all started with Biggie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Basically.
Go Biggie or go home.
Right. And the thing is, though, right, so we've talked before about, you know, doing needlepoint or any kind of like craft thing as a gift for someone. And then there's mm-hmm. always that feeling of like, you love it, but you don't know if the other person is going to love it. This is the kind of thing. So in my family, Biggie Smalls is huge, right? This is something
that's
like
awesome.
It's a giant bonding thing between me and my siblings, and like all of our kids know every song, you know, every word, every song, and which is kind of crazy because they're all singing them when they were really, really little, which made it even funnier.
yeah,
so for me to needlepoint Biggie Smalls for my brother, the irony of it would be perfect. Like, that is the perfect gift for him for all of the reasons that you just described. So I'm so glad that exists.
Oh, thank
awesome.
You.
Okay. You guys have an interesting story for how you got together. I mean, this was Tess's mother was kind of the one that brought you together, but tell the story mm-hmm. about how you found each other and got into this hobby, because, you know, this is, in many ways, a hobby that older people do, and it's so great to see young people enthusiastically involved and designing and doing stuff that's really different and unique. And so tell the story.
So my mom has been a needlepoint designer for oh my gosh. Sorry, my cat just knocked everything off my shelf.
great joy.
That's what cats do.
Oh, gosh. Okay, sorry. So my mom's been a needlepoint designer for 30-plus years. And so I basically, like, grew up – I remember, you know, as a little girl running around needlepoint shops with her. And so she has her own needlepoint line, Do Little Stitchery. And – she also works with Maria because she lives up in Dorset. So she works with Maria in Stitches Fine Needlepoint in Dorset, Vermont. And so Maria knows that my mom has this line and my mom's wholesales there. And so when Brooke went to speak with Maria about possibly starting a needlepoint line, Maria suggested that Brooke go and speak with my mom about, you know, how she could possibly get it started and just like the ins and outs of the business and stuff like that. I was living down in New Orleans at the time. But I happened to be visiting home when Brooke went to go speak with my mom on that day. And, and another part of this is that my mom had just taught me how to stitch paint because she was going to have me do a little bit of work for her needlepoint line, for do a little stitchery. So I was sitting there stitch painting literally when Brooke came over and,
You guys had never met, right?
No. Yeah, we had never met. So, that was our first time.
I never met Beth either.
Right. Oh, my mom is Beth. Yeah. So I kind of just like joined in on their conversation because I was just like really intrigued. And then when I saw what Brooke had, some of her like designs and her ideas, I was like blown away. And my mom jokes, she says that like she ran out like to run an errand. And she says that she like turned around for a second. When she got back, we were like in business. Brooke and I.
Yeah, I mean, it was so serendipitous. You know, I was just like, just graduated from college. I was trying to figure out, I had an idea of what I wanted to do, but not really. I was working in interior design. And, you know, I walk in with like 13 of my designs, not knowing what I was going to walk into. And then I didn't know Tessa's going to be there and stuff like that. And then, I don't know, just sometimes you meet someone and you get this feeling and it all just seemed to fall into place. So, yeah, that's when Tessa and Torrance started.
So Brooke, you have the art background?
Yeah, I mean, we both come from very creative families, but I studied art in school. I went to St. Lawrence University, but I've also studied at the University of Georgia. I studied at RISD, Rhode Island School of Design. I studied abroad like 3 times. So there's definitely, I definitely left school knowing that I wanted to be an artist. I just was trying to figure out what kind of vehicle to do that. And I love photography and I've tried it all. So this is really like a beautiful way to, you know, connect all of those interests. So whether it's styling photos or doing the actual designs or stitching or all of that. But we both wear a lot of hats and we try to balance it as much as we can.
So I'm curious about the mechanics of this thing. So Tess, your mother, obviously you had someone who knew how to paint canvases.
Mm-hmm.
So you had that. So you had at least that kind of training. So how do you guys does one of you design and the other paint and you both do the business, or how do you split things up?
I think Brooke has done more of the designs and I probably do more of the stitch painting, which is the actual painting on the canvas at, you know, stitch by stitch.
Right.
But with that being said, I've done some of our designs and Brooke also stitch paints. So, like she said, we wear many hats. And so we're sort of figuring out, I do a lot of the administrative stuff and, you know, Brooke made our website. And like I'll handle our Pinterest and Brooke mainly does the Instagram. So we kind of just split things up in the best way we can.
Yeah, but
we both do a lot. We share a lot of the responsibilities.
Yeah,
too.
We share a lot of the responsibility and we try our best to, you know, be respectful of, oh, I want to do this or I want to do this or I need to leave for a week. Do you mind manning the fort? So it definitely is really nice to have two of us for so many different reasons. But even, you know, if Tess wants to go to New Orleans for the weekend or if I need to go visit family or whatever, to be able to be like, okay, I have something that I need to do, that I need to pay attention to. And then, you know, one of us will be like, no problem, I'll take care of everything. So that's really, really nice too, just as a side tangent of, you know, operating this thing together.
Yeah, it gives you a lot of flexibility there. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, this lost in the right direction. I mean, you guys, just reading through your website, you guys have a unique look at needlepoint. You view it more, at least from what I took out of it, more than just something that you do as an art form. There's mm-hmm. more of a, I almost want to use the word zen. In your approach. Talk about that. What you really have it's an interesting approach, and you really had me thinking as I was preparing for this about what goes on in my head and what I'm doing when I'm stitching.
Yeah, I mean, we both have two very different takes on it. So, Tess, I'll let you go first.
Sure. So, for me, I think of needlepoint as a way to meditate. Because basically I'm doing something when I'm stitching and when I'm painting, but I'm speaking mostly about when I'm stitching, I'm doing something that's keeping me busy in terms of my hands are moving but I'm not thinking about what I'm doing. So it's sort of like, you know, some people consider like, will meditate when they're running or when they're doing the dishes, or it's just like a way to kind of zone out, but also be doing something repetitive that can get you sort of in that zone.
Right. That makes perfect sense to me. I do the same thing.
Yeah.
And for me, you know, both of my step-parents are Buddhist, and my mom owned a yoga studio when we first moved to Vermont. So kind of seeking healthy coping strategies has always been part of my life. I've studied meditation at Kripalu in the Berkshires, and, you know, when my parents split up or, you know, different things kind of came up, I always turned to art as kind of a way to self-soothe or to kind of try to redirect that energy to not only be reflective but resilient. And kind of maybe it's just because I've always been kind of the token artsy friend, but I kind of found that not everyone feels empowered to feel artistic. And, you know, not to be a cliche, but it's about the journey, not the destination. And just kind of that feeling that you get from it. Like, it doesn't, yes, it's nice to make something pretty, but it's just kind of that sense of release you get in creating something. So I think that because needlepoint is really mapped out for you, it's almost like stitched by colors, that as long as you have, you know, two working eyes, maybe you could do it with one eye, and two working hands, like anyone can do it. So like if you're on bed rest or like you just are getting over a surgery or, you know, you travel a lot or whatever, kind of the beauty of it is you can take it with you. It's very visually meditative, and that's kind of what we both took from it. So, you know, we live in an age where people are so focused on their phones, and I grew up in the mountains of Vermont. Like, we rarely had internet or TV or anything like that. So kind of just seeking other ways to keep busy is just kind of, I mean, now obviously I'm on my phone all the time, but I think now that people are starting to realize how dependent they are on technology, they're starting to seek other outlets, whether it's adult coloring books or knitting or I don't know.
Well, that's interesting because, I mean, there really has, I think many would say, been kind of a resurgence in needlework in general here in the last maybe 2-3 years. I had not put that together in my head that people just want to put their phones down and do something else. So,
I mean, I think it was really exciting for, you know, 15 years, however long you want to quantify it. But now that whether it's studies coming back or, you know, going out to dinner with your friends and everyone's on their phones and just taking a second and being like, wow, what are we doing? So I think people are starting to be more cognizant of that and hopefully trying to either recognize that or kind of find other things to still have that fidgety, almost necessity, but in a way that's productive. And also it lasts practically forever too.
Yeah. Right. It's nice to have something that, because you're right, we spend so much time doing something and at the end of it, we don't have anything to show for that time. And this is the exact opposite of that. You've spent the time, but then you have something that you've done at the end of it. So, yeah, I completely identify with the whole meditative aspect of it. I think that's it. And also sort of the healing part as well, because it is exactly the way to a quiet mind, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And we, you know, Tessa and I both have taught and recruited a lot of our friends. It's needlepointing, again, maybe people who didn't really have many hobbies or didn't really feel creatively empowered. And, you know, they get a few stitches in and they're like, wow, I just did that. Like, look, I just finished, and get so excited about it. So that's really beautiful. And then we also get emails from stitchers being like, thank you for helping me get through a really hard time. You know, I was needlepointing while my father was in the hospital. And I mean, there's all kinds of anecdotes that we get, but it's also those that keep us going too. But it's also really powerful to know that we, although we aren't physically there helping someone go through or celebrate something, we know that a tangent of, or an extension of something that we've created has. So that's really cool.
It is.
Because, see, you really had me, as I read through some of the stuff on your website, I really have been thinking more about what goes on when I stitch. Because for me, that so much of what I do is this mission to perfection and almost attacking it. And, because I'm going to get this just right, and I'm going to sit here till it's right, and if it's not quite, I'll tear it out and do it again. And you've had me just in the last couple of days, as I've been stitching, thinking, wait a minute, I need to, you know, take the edge off of this. And
it should be stressful.
Yeah.
Well, you know, it's funny though, Gary. So in other hobbies that we do, it's exactly mirrored, because the way that you and I go about doing the exact same task is the exact polar opposite, because you are always very controlled, mission oriented, organized, everything's done the same exact way every single time. And my approach to it is, let's look at it, see what's going on, and then kind of just roll with things. So as much as I do rip things out, it's more because I'm learning something. I don't have that need for something to be perfect. In our previous hobbies, we're in this as well. Like there, I have things that are very imperfect, and some of them catastrophically so, and I love them for that reason. So, and I cannot imagine Gary doing that, like being okay with that, because I just feel like it would be under your skin, and it would not be okay with you.
Right,
so it's funny
not.
Because we it's totally not right. So and I look at those things, and that's part of, you know, that's part of what what you guys were talking about before, the, you know, very Buddhist statement, it's the journey. That's part of what making that was about, was it's not about the finished project necessarily. Sometimes, sometimes it's about, you know, oh, well, I remember. Okay. So I'll give you a totally unrelated example. I have a tattoo. I may or may not have more than one.
We do too. It's fine.
and it's funny because so one of them is jellyfish, and the tendrils are very long and flowy, and you know, just these perfectly beautiful sculpted curvy lines. And there's one spot in one of them that's completely jagged, right? And not to the, it only to the point that I would notice. Mm-hmm. It's probably one of my favorite parts, because it was a moment where my sister and I were in the tattoo shop, and we were talking about our other sister, and we just started laughing so much that obviously the artist was having a hard time. And so he kind of jolted, right? So that imperfection is such a great, you know, sort of time marker of a great memory. So
I love that.
Yeah. So every time I look at it, I think of, you know, sitting with my sister and laughing about our other sister's terrible tattoos. And it's just, I love that, that you know, I love that mistake because it's not a mistake anymore. You know, it's a really cool memory. So, but, and so errors like that sometimes for me, I think that's why I have a little bit more tolerance. And I think it's personality change, but that's also a way that Gary and I complement each other is that we approach things very differently.
Right.
That way. And I think that's why we get along because we don't understand each other ever.
Very much could be it. Yes. Yeah. Cause that's, yeah. And I like this, Lady Edith thing. I have an error in there. I made an error because I got cocky, but I couldn't tear it out because if I tore it out, basically I had so many other stitches anchored to it that I'd have to pretty much start over. And so I stitched over it. And the only person who could ever tell is Gay Ann Rogers because she designed it and me.
Oh, well, that's
yeah. And you know, I mean,
well,
but I had
never
to,
mind,
I,
Edith.
Yeah, I had to stitch over it. I mean, you can't tell, but I know it's there, and that will forever bug me about that piece. you know, and my wife's going to have it framed, and she wants to make it into an easel. And that'll be one where I will just look past it. I know I will. because to me, it's not right. And I couldn't fix it, because to fix it meant really tearing out just everything, and I'd have just thrown it away. I wouldn't have bothered. And, but see that, yeah, that's the difference. Yeah, I can't, it's going to bug me forever. Yeah.
It's imperfectly perfect, Gary.
That's right.
Yeah, no.
I think Gary needs to read No Mud, No Lotus. That's what I think.
Yeah.
No Mud, No Lotus?
Yes.
That sounds like
that's
a poem.
That's my recommendation. No.
You need mud to grow lotus.
That's right. That's a book I'm going to send you, Gary.
Okay. I feel culture engulfing me here.
Yes, you should. You should.
For opening your mind, Gary.
I'm scared.
But how great is this that all of this great conversation about sort of different cultural ways of approaching things is born out of a common love of needlepoint? You know, who would have thought that that would be the driver of this conversation?
Yeah, and that's kind of the approach that we try to take, you know, in all aspects of what we do, because, I mean, I'm 24 and I've moved over 20 times and, you know, Tess has lived in a lot of different cities too, and we have a lot of interests and have traveled quite a bit. So kind of with a grand tour approach, you know, just taking different teachings or visuals or palettes or whatever you want to call it and creating these compositions of combining those things not only allow some of our designs to transcend culturally, but also in time too. For example, we have a Buddhist Buddha design, our damask Buddha design. It has a damask background. And I studied abroad in Cortona, Italy, if you've ever seen Under the Tuscan Sun. That's where I lived. And we would every Saturday travel to a different Italian city. And I just loved the Byzantine art and the Baroque and Rococo eras. So kind of combining. And the dorm I lived in was a converted monastery. So kind of combining just a bunch of different themes from few months of my life is kind of how that design came to be. But I had also, when I lived in London, had gone to Sir John Soane, his house, and he was a very well-known architect, but also grantor-y. And he would bring back from his travels, he had like an ancient Egyptian sarcophagus in his basement, but he also had like all these crazy things in this one Victorian home. And it was really cool that you could almost travel around the world in a single house. So not only catering to different tastes or people or whatever, but you know, creating combinations aesthetically derived from different cultural aspects.
With your designs, just looking through your designs, I get a sense, just playing off of that, that in a lot of ways your designs are making statements.
Mm-hmm.
Can I say that safely? That that even the elephant, can I read into it that that's kind of a, we need to protect them?
Yeah, absolutely.
That's what's in your head when you put a lot of these together, is there's more of a purpose other than just something pretty to stitch.
Yeah, I would say so. Yeah, like the Rosie the rhino, it's like the small round.
Mm-hmm.
The horn is pink because they started dyeing those pink so that if anyone tried to steal the ivory, it would stop them from doing that. So that's why we did the horn pink on that.
Yeah. So kind of, I've always been really, both of us have always been really concerned about how the exotic animal trade industry impacts our ecosystem. And back for my senior thesis in college, I built a life-size elephant out of chicken wire, tulle, and spent bullet shells. So there's a new initiative of using these magenta darts for the rhinos that are non-toxic to the rhinos, but toxic to human consumption, because there are different ways that people consume or use those horns. So not only does the dye eliminate that ivory-like aspect to them, but also for different medicinal purposes that they're used for, that kind of eliminates, it kind of eliminates the incentive to kill the rhinos.
Right.
And then just a little plug, like 98 elephants are killed a day because of their tusks. So there's been a drastic decline, and they're projected to go extinct in about 20 years. So without being like, save the elephants, or whatever you want to call it, that's kind of honoring those animals in a way that's not harmful to them, is kind of, and maybe educating, you know, people along the way subtly. Although I'm happy to go on a rant. we both believe in at least making every effort to leave our planet better than we found it. And so if we, you know, educate a few people about an issue, then that's pretty cool. So all of our animals have names. So one of our lions is named Cecil after, the lion that was killed. Or, you know, little monikers like the magenta horn or golden tusks, things like that, because they have a monetary value.
It's refreshing and thought-provoking, that because, you know, most needlepoint, I mean, there's not that extra dimension to most needlepoint,
right,
by any stretch. Mm-hmm. And as I looked at your designs, that just kind of started coming to me. Wait a minute, there's more to it than just an elephant or a rhino or a lion. This is something else, and that's,
it's a conversation starter, right? It's the beginning of a conversation as opposed to the end of a project.
Yeah, right. But we also want to respect those who could care less.
okay.
which I mean, not maybe respect isn't the right word, but not offend. So if
embrace them. Right. For some people, it is just a beautiful piece.
Right.
Yeah. We try to be mindful. You know, there's every kind of person, and, you know, there are people who really are passionate about it, and then some who are like, I don't live there, why should I care? Which is actually something that I get once in a while. Or from other people. And so we want to create, you know, these unique, beautiful things, but things that aren't necessarily going to straight out offend anyone too.
And the other part of what you guys do is to try and involve younger people in this hobby. And I've had this discussion with more than one stitcher and knitter about, you know, it's in many ways an aging hobby, and you know, a lot of people, we need more young people involved, and you guys are actively, I mean, you talked about actively involving your friends, getting them to learn what an enjoyment needlepoint can be. And I think that's just a neat thing because you guys are young ladies doing this. You're really kind of an anomaly in the hobby, and it's just so refreshing to see you push the hobby and tout the hobby, I guess it is, to your peers.
And it kind of goes back to what we were saying earlier, where a lot of people, well, I'm a little bit older than Brooke. I'm like going to be 32 this month, but I have, you know, it's the same idea where, you know, everybody's in their phones. So we're sort of pushing the idea that it's a way to unplug and to basically, it's like a way to honor the past and create for the future type thing.
And I know this speaks true to Tess too, but my great grandmother needlepointed, my grandmother needlepointed. She taught my mom when she was six. My aunts on my mom's side all needlepoint. It's really been, I mean, it's in my blood. And I know for a fact it's in Tess's too. And I mean, for lack of a better phrase, it's borderline endangered. And kind of what kept us out of the loop is, you know, we're very creative artists, so, you know, aesthetics play a part into it. And while there are very beautiful traditional pieces, it's something that you spend a lot of time and money in or on. And so we kind of try to think outside the box, not only with designs that probably could be used as a vehicle to try to recruit, if you will, but also finishing ideas too. Like, I'm really excited because I just got back our Lily canvas as an iPad case, but it's functional. It's an art piece, or it could be an iPad case, or I could use it as a clutch for like a more posh event or something like that. And then we had a woman who is just finished stitching our Purple Haze, the Jimi Hendrix design. Mm-hmm. And she was like, I really want to do this for my son. Like, do you have any ideas other than like a pillow for him? He's in college. I think he's in college. And I was like, well, tell me more about him. Like, what does he do? Like, da 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 da. And she was like, well, he really plays guitar. And I was like, hello, make him mm-hmm. a zip pouch for his strings and picks that he can keep in his case. Or maybe like doing camera straps or I don't know. So not only trying to think outside the box of designs, but also how they could translate into finished pieces. So yeah, I guess that's kind of trying to, you know, things that are trending, just trying to figure out, you know, neither of us ever make something that we wouldn't want for ourselves or have in our home. So everything is an extension of ourselves and our tastes, and we just kind of hope that other people will like them too. I mean, I'm 24, so I make things that I think are cool and I would want. And then it's just kind of a leap of faith in hoping that, you know, other people will like it too. And thankfully, you know, people do. So.
I like the idea of, and I think this is probably one of the reasons that you're successful at bringing in people who wouldn't normally be attracted to the hobby, is the idea of using things not just as a framed piece on the wall, because there's so many things that you could make that are fun to make because they're challenging or interesting. But then afterwards, it's like you said, you wouldn't like, I'd love to make that, but then I don't want it. Right. So, like, what am I going to do with this thing now that I have it? And that's when you go to somebody's grandmother's house and they have all those like weird crafts, usually in the bathroom because nobody else wants to put them anywhere else. Right. So it's cool to think about, okay, now it, like the talking about camera straps or guitar straps, you know, how else can we use this piece of art, you know, make it a useful item instead of just a beautiful item. And that is kind of an interesting way. And it is something that people are more likely to do, especially people who don't want to then decorate their homes, especially younger people, with, you know, elderly looking needlepoint designs on the wall. And there's nothing wrong with that. But again, you're trying to appeal to a different aesthetic, you know, from an interior design perspective as well. So finding other applications for it is kind of a cool idea.
I mean, we see through Needlepoint Nation, as I know you guys too, like there are a lot of different ways that you could have something finished. But one of the themes that Tess and I find is people asking us what we do is one of the hardest questions I come across, because in the circles that we're in, it's a very small chance that people even know what needlepoint is.
Mm-hmm.
So we're constantly trying to think about it from people who just don't do it. So that's why like Instagram's so effective, because it's so visual. But, you know, really thinking outside the box of what it could be. And so one way that, I mean, the common question we get is, well, what do you do with it afterwards? And, you know, one of the things that I try to explain is any sort of surface that has any sort of like wood or fabric or leather or whatever you want to call it can be replaced with needlepoint. So whether that's, you know, upholstering it onto a chair, or I have this massive piece that I'm working on that I want to incorporate into a headboard or coasters or all kinds of things. So
do you guys find yourself holding impromptu orientation classes for needlepoint?
Test us.
Yeah, it's actually was really funny. Yesterday, I was making a video for a friend teaching her how to basket weave, and I just, like, sent it to her email. And, like, people were walking by, and my friend was videotaping, and she was, like, practically on top of me, video, like, because it was just really funny. It was really bizarre. And I sent it to her, and I think it was helpful for her because she was struggling with it.
Yeah, how-to videos are in our forecast.
Yeah.
So keep your eye
out. I actually realized that it's not that difficult to do over video. Like, I think it'll be really beneficial.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
Tell me about painting canvases. I've never done that. I know that there's canvases where they have machines do it, and it can get the actual lines get kind of close, but they're not always where they need to be for stitching. And
right.
when you guys, you stitch paint, so you're painting exactly where the stitches would begin and end. Talk about how do you go about all that?
So when we hand paint, we're stitch painting them. So basically our process is we'll paint what we want to see on the canvas. And then we'll have to go back and basically make sure that it makes sense in terms of stitch painting. So if you're looking at your canvas, you know to use red instead of purple on that one stitch. But when you're looking at it overall, it makes sense as a design. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and I think, you know, one of the limitations to needlepoint in terms of design, because it's almost like a really really low resolution photo or very pixelated. Mm-hmm. So you just try to think of it in that mentality. And Tess is much more meticulous and better at it than I am. But, you know, the standard for this industry is for things to be stitch painted. Canvases either come printed, hand painted, or hand stitch painted, because it is a bit of a luxury hobby, and because it really, that stitch painted method really eliminates a lot of the guesswork. So there's no discrepancy of, oh, where was this supposed to go? Like, you know, when you buy the canvas or when you look at the canvas, that more or less that's what it's going to look like when it's stitched. So, I mean, we both have different processes. I maybe do a sketch, certainly if there's typography, just because that's important to keep it consistent. But I just kind of put on some tunes or New Girl and just kind of go for it. You probably can't tell that I wear a lot of black and white, but I love color when it comes to interior design. So just really trying to think of color harmonies and you know, I've always been a big fan of having like a neutral home with pops of color.
Mm-hmm.
We just kind of try to take something and translate it into needlepoint. And it's been really funny because my mom's decor aesthetic is very Rembrandt, whereas my aunt was very like Susan Sargent. So I've definitely had a lot of different conflicting influences, and also even just simply working in interior design. And I actually, not many people know this, but I work for an interior designer part-time on top of Tess and Thorne. So just being really aware of current things that are happening in the design world. Also, again, just simply things that we love, because I think we both are big fans of really buying things that we love. And so kind of translating those into needlepoint is kind of our design process.
And when you stitch, say you stitch the first one, and then the second and third and fourth and fifth, do they all vary to some degree? Or do you, once you have one, do you then use some kind of a template or something so they're all exactly the same?
For the most part, they're exactly the same. And then there's a few designs where there might be like a few stitches that are different, or, but I would say for the most part, they're all the same.
Okay.
Yeah, we tend to, like after I finish, because we do work from two different studios, I'll be like, Tess, I just finished this design. And then I'll scan it and send it to her, and then she'll print it out. And then she has an exact model of what it should look like when it's copied. So that's really effective. You know, some designs call that they have to be precise and rendered verbatim, whereas others you can kind of fudge it a little bit. So we try to keep them consistent.
Or do you paint to order, or do you try and build up an inventory of your various designs?
We try to have an inventory. We do a lot of painting.
Well, that's what I was thinking. Yeah, you must be doing a lot of painting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we do. It's really time consuming, because, you know, for me, I you know, it's a lot of counting. So you have to like count out like, okay, that's like 15 stitches down in blue. So I count one, two, you know, and so, you know, I've gotten a lot faster at it, but in the beginning it was like even more time consuming. It would take me very long to paint it all out. But so we do like to have as much inventory, but like, so we know that some designs sell more than others. So those ones we make sure we have on hand, and then others will paint once we get them ordered or get an order for.
How long would it take to do, you know, an average size canvas painted?
It really depends on the complexity of the design. And also depends on how many times we've done it. It is very time consuming.
Yeah.
It depends on the size, the amount, the number of colors in the design, and then like what Brooke said, the complexity, like if it's like more intricate, and if there's not really like the elephant, like there's not really a pattern to it, so those can sometimes take longer,
right?
If it's not repetitive, like if the pattern doesn't repeat itself.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's hard to memorize. Really depends. Yeah.
Well, see, I think it's important for people to hear what goes into these painted canvases, because when it comes to painted canvases, one of the complaints you'll always hear is they're so expensive. But
yeah,
but mm-hmm. they are, when you know what goes into them, you can start to appreciate why they're expensive. I mean, it's lots of hours, lots of tedious
right.
work. I mean, if you're sitting there counting threads to get it exactly right, that's a lot of tedious work. And then you got to put the paint on and have it be just so. The line's got to be clean. You don't want mm-hmm. You don't want the holes filled with paint. I mean, there's a lot of.
That's clean and consistent.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, that's definitely, you know, when you go behind the scenes, these things definitely take a lot of time and care. And, you know, one of the things for people our age is like, golly, how am I going to afford to do that? And the thing is, well, A, it keeps you entertained for a very long time. So if you think about other things that you do that you pay a lot of money for that maybe occupy you for a couple hours or something like that, like this definitely keeps you engaged for a very long time. It also, mm-hmm. You know, you can have it forever. Like I have pillows that my grandmother made, and I never really got the chance to get to know her very well. So that's really special. And you can give them as gifts. Like there are all these different benefits to it, but there is a lot of work that goes into them, but I mean, at the end of the day, like, they are paintings, they are pieces of art. So one of the things that we like to kind of use to engage others is, you know, every canvas is a collaborative artwork, because we create something and then someone makes it their own. And, you know, we've seen one design come back to us in photographs 25 different ways. So other people change the colors or do different stitches, or maybe they do velvets or metallics or whatever. I mean, at the end of the day, it's a piece of art and in some way an investment. So yeah. It's expensive.
Do you guys, a lot of people, it seems these days, a lot of these painted canvases, people won't do them unless they have a stitch guide. Do you try to provide some kind of a stitch guide, or do you just paint the canvas and then that's up to someone else?
Yeah, we don't currently do the stitch guides, no.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, that's kind of a newer concept to us because, we're, you know, new-ish to the needlepoint industry, but also kind of the beauty of it is making it your own, and we really encourage people to make it their own. And obviously, if people are like, you know, what threads did you use or whatever, and in fact, we're going to do a blog of different recipes, if you will, of what kind of fibers to use that we've kind of curated. And obviously people can do whatever they want, but some people really do want direction. So as far as stitch guides, we don't know, because I think we come up with new designs too quickly. You know, the beauty of it is seeing how people have changed it to their own aesthetic, or, you know, maybe they make it more masculine for their boyfriend, husband, or brother, or...
Yeah, we really loved seeing how people changed it up a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
It's really fun.
Yeah, that must be fun. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's super fun.
You have so many designs. You guys have just kind of a double mental stream of ideas coming out of you that you almost can't get them on canvas fast enough?
Exactly. That's exactly right.
Our, like, to-do list is ridiculous. Gosh, we need, like, 8 more of us.
Yeah.
Do people send you requests of things that they'd like to see you translate into needlepoint?
Yeah. We get a lot of requests.
When we first started, we did a lot of custom work. And then once in a while, we'll do like a hashtag suggestion Saturday, because we know what we like. But sometimes, whether it's just kind of reiterating, you know, yes, we should create this, or wow, we never really. I mean, a lot of things we kind of already had on our to-do list, but maybe there's a slight alteration to it. You know, we did a couple of Grateful Dead designs because my mom's a big Deadhead and went to a couple concerts when she was pregnant with me. So that was kind of a thing that we did. So then a lot of people were like, we want to see fish. So I don't know. It's fun to hear feedback, but then once in a while we'll get suggestions where we're like, you know, we appreciate it, but maybe reach out to this designer. We've gotten some pretty interesting requests.
I had somebody recently tell me that we should offer designs where you can put your Wi-Fi password on a needlepoint and then sell them to people so they can stitch them and hang them on their wall.
I like that idea. That's a funny idea, actually.
Yeah, that was really funny.
But we've gotten some pretty interesting requests because, you know, we're a bit rebellious and have a quirky sense of humor. I mean, one of our first 5 designs had some profanity in it. So we definitely get some interesting designs, but we also have to be mindful of how far we can push the boundary. I don't know. It's been a really fun experience, not only designing for ourselves, because I think that's kind of our primary way of going about things, but also trying to figure out how to give the people what they want.
But it sounds like you have a really good sort of relationship with your clientele, you know, that you have a lot of sort of dialogue, feedback going in both directions. It's not just you guys making designs. It's, you know, taking ideas and talking, you know, it seems like there's more of a give and take, which I have to imagine makes it a lot more rewarding and fun to do.
Right.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, it does.
We have clients, if you will, who have collected our designs. I mean, I can think of five people off the top of my head who have at least seven of our canvases. So that's been really rewarding. But also, I think they just get so excited to show us what they do. And one of the things that we really try to do is we really love showing off our stitchers and their work. So kind of that incentive of sending us photos not only helps us, but also maybe that confirmation makes them want to stitch one of our designs or send us photos or whatever in the hopes of us reposting it or something like that. So that's really effective. But we have really great relationships with our stitchers, and it's awesome that, you know, this woman in Dallas has seven of our canvases and we've never met her before, but, you know, we've created things that are in her home that she, you know, keeps returning to us, which is really, really special. We also, there's a shop called Village Needleworks in Omaha, Nebraska, and the owner, Mary, reached out to us. She's definitely one of our best clients, and she emailed us about a month ago saying, like, I don't know what you girls have done, but I've owned this shop for 10 years and I've never seen as many young women in here consistently as they are. So that's really cool too.
Well, see, that's a victory right there. That's tremendous.
Right.
Yeah. And, you know, I don't think either of us, in a positive way, like, try to read too much into anything, just because maybe it's the meditation. I don't know what it is, but, you know, when we do get emails like that, it's like, wow, I didn't realize people liked us that much. So I think it's really rewarding, but also kind of a push to keep going, which is really great.
Well, that, I mean, that right there to me is game changing. If you've got somebody commenting that you're putting younger people in shops through your designs, that's a shot in the arm for the hobby in general. That really is, that has to feel good, because that's, I've heard more than one person speak about being concerned that the hobby was dying because the people who stitch are just getting old. And for a store owner to make that kind of a comment, that's really exciting in a way.
Yeah, according to the National Needle Arts Association, their 2016 report, there's an estimate of about 56,000 needle pointers. I'm hoping it's more than that, but that's kind of what they've gathered from, you know, the surveys that they've gotten back. And they also estimate that the average needle pointer is 62 years old.
That sounds about right.
So, you know, I think there's been a bit of a perpetual cycle catering to that audience. Which is fine, but I think that, you know, if we're in it for the long run, we really have to think about the future. And part of that is rethinking about the whole industry. You know, we're one of the first designers, not the first, I shouldn't say that, but of our genre who sell directly online. And that in itself has been a bit of a controversy. You know, we really do try to push our stitchers to support local shops, because we think that's really important. And, you know, Tess and I are both from a community that really, you know, thrives off of shopping local. So it's something that's important to us. But we also, you know, we grew up in the age of Amazon Prime. I mean, people want to not have to talk to anyone and just order something online and it to show up at their door and, you know, whatever you want to call it. So we don't want to box them out either. So we definitely, you know, try to play both games, because accessibility is really the name of the game. So whether that's through design work, whether that's through thinking outside the box of how those designs can be finished, and also just how to get them in your hands to begin with.
That whole thing, how to go to market, it's a real fine line there. It's a difficult challenge, because Even people who would normally go to stores, it's not hard to find many of them who don't have a store near them. And, you know, without the internet, they wouldn't have access to what's available. So it's really a tough thing, because I mean, I've said many times, I'm Welcome Stitchery is my store, and I do everything I can to support them because I want them around. But
right, exactly.
But by the same token, others don't have that option, and yeah, there are people. I don't want to interact with people. I just want it to show up at my door.
Yeah, and you know, we do try to be mindful with our choices, and we do try to respect how this industry has been ran for, you know, who knows how long. And I mean, we don't have to, but we still buy our fibers full retail from our local shop. We still do our finishing through them. And we do really, I mean, we have like a shop local page on our website, and where we list, I have to update it, but a good chunk of the shops that we sell to. And, yeah, we do try to keep that conversation going, but at the same time, like, being mindful of, there are people who are intimidated of going into a shop, particularly people who've never needlepointed before.
Or don't even have any idea that that's what you're supposed to do.
Yeah, don't even have a shop to begin with. And that's something that we try to convey to our shops. And, you know, the majority of them are like, no problem, we get it. And there are some who are like, don't even bother trying us again, which is fine. I mean, you know, they've got their thing, we've got our thing, but we are trying to convey that we are mindful of all sides of the coin, but are really just trying to, you know, keep needlepoint going and recruit more stitchers.
Yes.
So okay. That's our mission.
Yeah, well, it's a good mission to have, and you know, now we're going to run out of time here. So, yeah, I really have enjoyed this, but we have to do recommendations. Did you guys have any recommendations?
One TED Talk that I think is really awesome is Elizabeth Gilbert. She wrote Eat, Pray, Love and recently came out with Big Magic. And that's definitely one that I would recommend. But she has this TED Talk called The Elusive Creative Genius that I think is really cool. And a friend of mine showed this to me years and years ago. But it's been really... This is a really powerful way of thinking about life and living creatively. And then also, you know, we use Instagram as one of our major vehicles for, you know, just getting our name out there and telling our story. And one book that has been really helpful for us, if you're on a budget and can't go to social media summits like we've been able to do, it's called Capture Your Style, and it's by Amy Song. And she's, you know, this very, very successful fashion blogger that kind of really gets into the nitty gritty and kind of creates a basic understanding of how to optimize Instagram to market your business or, you know, be able to really share your story of visual arts effectively. So I think that is a really cool, you know, if you really want to start like a cross-stitch blog or I don't know, whatever you want to do, I think it's a really cool read. It's pretty quick and it has some really awesome information, and we've definitely taken some notes from it.
Yeah, I have one recommendation that I've been trying. This is not nearly as deep as those two, but I read somewhere where someone suggested that when you end a stitching session to start the thread for when start the next thread. So like you end a thread, start the next thread, anchor it and pull it through so that when you get back to stitching, you can sit down and stitch right away. Well, but you can sit down and stitch right away so that the stitching starts immediately instead of sitting there and cutting a thread and fumbling and figuring out where you're going to be. That's already been determined and you can start to stitch. And I've been really practicing that, trying to make it a habit. And that's hard to do, but trying to make that a habit. And it really has been a difference maker when I've done it. Because yeah, I sit down and I'm immediately stitching. So I'm immediately doing what I enjoy. And I do mostly charted stuff or virtually all charted stuff. So I'm not sitting there first looking at the chart and counting and making sure I start in the right spot and all that stuff. That's all been predetermined for me. And it's really been a plus for me to have that. So I wanted to get that.
Try
out.
That.
Yeah.
Yeah, I like it.
And that's and my awesome. Apologies to whoever gave me that idea because I have no idea, but but yeah, it's been so that's been working for me. Yeah.
That's a really great suggestion.
Yep. Ladies, thank you so much. This has
been
thank you so much.
Yeah.
Thank you. This has been really fun.
Yep. Really appreciate it and learned a lot out of you guys. That's great. Yep. And,
yeah.
Thank you. Thank you
so much, you guys.
Patient with us too.
No, thank you so much. It's really been great.
Yep. And with that, we'll end Fiber Talk. Be sure and visit our website, We Talk Fiber. And of course, as with all the podcasts, for this one, there will be a ton of links for Brooke and Tess, their website, their Instagram, all kinds of things on the page for this website. So you can connect with them in many, many ways, see their work, and definitely go to their website and see their designs because they are really captivating. Yes.
Thank you. Really appreciate that.
All right. Thanks to everyone for listening.